Greetings and good afternoon to everyone listening. This is Clarence Jones from the Commonwealth of Kwanzaa Society's talk show.
This show has been created to bring to light the need for a centralized culture in the African-American community and to show how many of the struggles in the Black community are rooted in a lack of a centralized African-based culture in the Black race as it exists in the Western Hemisphere and Western civilization. My name is Clarence Jones, your host today, and I'm going to use my show to make a case to use the fall holiday of Kwanzaa as a new platform for the Black community to use to unify different types of Black people. And Kwanzaa would be taken and turned into a year-round system instead of a part-time of the year, part of the year holiday. A legitimate question, of course, is what does Kwanzaa give to the Black community? Why Kwanzaa? Why was it chosen as this platform? What is it about Kwanzaa that makes it such a positive process or positive instrument or tool that can be utilized by the Black community and Black race in a positive way? Kwanzaa is African. It is of Africa, but not specific to a particular tribe of African people. So it is inclusive to all African peoples. Kwanzaa is a first fruits harvest celebration that does not infringe upon religion, nationality, geography, or ethnicity. The African peoples need an ancestry-based system that all Black people can rally around. This would lead to better camaraderie, familiarity, which would lead to more continuity, and then more camaraderie. This ultimately would come together and would give the Black community an enhanced ability to organize, coordinate, and orchestrate, and of course, the results of all these processes together that I just mentioned is what is called unity. Unity is a word that's thrown around too easily in this society. You know, you can't be unified if you're a race of people or organization where I can treat you poorly, and then when it's necessary, we have to come together when it's convenient for me. You'll see that in a lot of poor teams. And I'm into my introduction, but I'm going to use a couple of examples when I played as a football player. When I played for the New Orleans Saints, I got a lot of money, had a big contract, and wasn't that well-respected by the team. There was a lot of resentment, and like many poor teams, and the Saints were poor when I was there, we weren't a good organization. We tried hard, but we didn't sustain what we needed to sustain to be a consistently great team. What you'll notice in those instances, be it race, organization, corporate, any type of team, you have a lot of people that are concerned with someone else instead of being concerned with themselves. The essence of a great team or great organization is the individuality of its members, meaning not that we're individuals, we don't care about the group. We're individuals, we're concerned with our performance and excellence first before we worry about anyone else. And so, The Saints, in my experience, reminds me of that word unity and how it is thrown around and used, but it's not necessarily lived by an organization, ethnic group, or race of people. You have to live unity. It can't just be a word. And so the Saints were a perfect example of that in 1996 when I was there, because there was a lot of shade or negativity. I just felt that now, in all fairness, I got a big contract with the Saints. And in that instance, it was 1996, and the free agency had started in 1993. And what ended up happening with free agents, it hit in such a way that high-end players were not going to necessarily get a big contract. it was the mid-level guys that were just starting because they had the youth with them. So signing a long-term contract over 2 years, which is a long-term, would be 3 years plus 3 to 4 or 5 years, would give you a huge signing bonus. And so at that time, you had a lot of guys that were getting these nice, huge contracts in the NFL that were not all pros. They were not Lawrence Taylor. They were not Reggie White. You know, the high end. They were not Joe Montana, the great players of that era, Dan Marino. Those guys were getting their money anyway. But there were a lot of young guys that, like, this is their first year as a starter, that were able to capitalize on the, you know, the new free agency that existed in professional football in the mid-90s. And so what you saw was what you saw were the younger guys that were started proven professionals, proven, you know, starting level performers, but not necessarily stars. They were paid for their potential, and the fact that they were younger meant that they would most likely, you know, not have the injuries that an older guy is. You know, I don't care how good you are as an old athlete, even as a dominant athlete, the body can do only what it can do. And so you're technically not supposed to be able to do play at a certain level after a certain age. Tom Brady winning a Super Bowl at 40 is unheard of. That's never been done before, where he's the primary. There may be guys on Super Bowl teams that were older, but they weren't required to do as much to help those teams get over. And so with Tom Brady still the primary source of offense, the primary weapon, is, you know, that was unheard of. That has not been done in all of sports, much less professional football. So the adage that paying young players and not paying old players is consistent with sports, that at a certain age you got to get the big contract and all the money you can get, as particularly when you're young, because when you start waning, as injuries pile up and your age piles up, your value goes down. You know, that's, you know, part of life of being a professional athlete. So when free agency started in 93, the people capitalizing from the mid-90s on were the mid-level young guys who just started. So bringing that to the New Orleans Saints, you have a relatively young guy with a big contract. A lot of players weren't that happy. And then the pressure is, now you got to perform, which I really did not. You know, I there were things that my weaknesses at the pro level, whatever your weaknesses are, you might be able to get over in high school, college. Your other aspects of your game may be so dominant that your weaknesses are not as prevalent. They're not as relevant because you're dominant in other areas. At that pro level, it just, your weaknesses become more pronounced. And so once I got that starting spot in New Orleans, there was a little bit of resentment from the team that I got. And I felt that coming into the locker room. I felt that walking to the car. Now, I think that's a good thing because it just means you want to earn this money and you want to be the player that's worthy of this contract. And so, you know, the thing that keeps you in with a job and the thing that puts you over and allows you to achieve your dreams as an athlete is your dreams, is your competitive nature, the need to be great, the drive to be great. And I definitely had that. But the fact is, I never became great. So there were definitely resentment in that locker room amongst my teammates. Now, here's where unity comes in, and here's where the lesson can be learned from other groups and showing the need of Kwanzaa and what Kwanzaa can do. Given a playbook, how we treat one another, how we work with one another. Any team, in as far as building unity, needs to do things off the field together to build that continuity, that confidence in one another, that jovialness, that camaraderie, which we mentioned earlier. That has sometimes that's natural, sometimes it has to be worked at. And so a lot of times you have guys inviting people over for dinner, for cookouts, bowling, anything that we could do together that's away from the field that can give that familiarity with each other and that confidence. Actually, everything I mentioned in the beginning, that familiarity, continuity, which leads to a better ability to organize. Absolutely everything I mentioned in my intro of why Kwanzaa, what does it give? Well, all teams are trying to build that. And if they're successful, they do build that, and it becomes strong. When you have that negativity, when you have a guy like me that's not necessarily meshing in, so when the players, my teammates invited me over to go to these things, I laughed, like, oh, hell no, I'm not going to any team event or any – I'm not interested in dealing with stuff off the field with y'all. I don't feel that connection to y'all. I don't feel that trust with y'all. I don't feel that respect from y'all, literally. I think and I think I was right. But is that ultimately good for a team trying to mesh in? And obviously it's not. The answer to that is you got to – give guys the tools they need to have success because there are repercussions in dealing with your organization, dealing with your team that messes with your continuity. But it was just, I felt bad. I didn't feel bad, but I understood what they were trying to do as far as trying to build a team camaraderie. But I did not feel that respect and trust with my teammates. As a matter of fact, there were a couple of altercations that we got into off the field in the parking lot as a result of those feelings and that. So that was a situation that was potentially dangerous dealing with my teammates. My focus was to come and be all pro and to take the mentality that, okay, I'm getting a lot of money. Bottom line, my production on the field isn't where I want it to be anyway. My main thing I should be doing is focusing on being all pro, playing at a very high level. This other stuff will eventually work itself out. Now, this is what I call trust and camaraderie effect in an organization, meaning when you have someone doing something they don't do well, there are repercussions beyond just not accomplishing the task. Now your morale of your organization is now marginalized from this. So this is something that has to be thought of from up top. From a cultural standpoint, we need a playbook, we need protocols, we need rules and regulations how to deal with one another. If you don't agree, if you don't like this person, or if this person hasn't accomplished their task, maybe they need to be taken off this task. Maybe things need to be done to make sure all the things are given to them so they can complete their task. All these things have to come into play when you talk about an individual accomplishing a task within an organization. And so I call that the trust and unity factor. That trust and camaraderie factor, that's a big issue in teams and any team. And so that word unity, and I went into it a little bit because, you know, I've been talking about it in my intro for weeks now, for a couple of sessions now, and I just wanted to get into that people throw this word around unity, and it is not necessarily it's not a word just to be thrown around that people usually do. There's meaning behind it. It has to be lived. It has to be experienced for it to have any type of relevance. Okay. So unity, back to the intro, unity is a key ingredient that has been lacking in the Black population or has been at the root of many of its struggles and challenges of being a major impediment to its ability to work together, to protect itself, to educate itself, and to help itself against its struggles and its enemies as one force. And I want to use this show to make a case for the need of a central culture in the Black population and for the practicality of using Kwanzaa as that cultural platform. I'm going to cite my history, my personal life as a pro athlete, current events, and books I've read as illustrations of that need of a for a central culture in the Black population. Now, we talked about unity and how that's a problem in the Black community, and one problem is it's a word that's simply thrown around, I think, incorrectly, and how it's not a word. You have to have rules and regulations if you're going to be a strong team. You have to have rules and regulations on how to treat one another if you're going to be unified. So unified means we're on the same page. I'm as accountable as you. You're as accountable as me. I may have a more important job based on my ability. You may have a lesser job, but we're both important, but we're both accountable to whatever mission we have. And that's what any team has. And a culture gives that to an ethnic group. And the Black community not having that culture has definitely been a major problem for it over the years. And so I just watched Black News last night, and it talked, and my daughter talked about this. I got into an argument with my daughter a couple of months ago. It wasn't an argument, it was a discussion, but my point was there's a, you know, war on Black men. We need more support for Black men. And that, you know, with the police shootings and all kind of things, and then, you know, jobs and high levels of them doing drugs, high levels of them in the penal system, in the criminal justice system. Her point was that actually Black women are under siege, and a lot of them are being abducted, and bad things are being done to them, and no one cares. And so last night on Black News on cable, I saw the story, and I wasn't shocked. I knew, but last night I heard, you know, that these are grown women that are things happen to them, little kids, that things happen, and you never hear of it. And so that is absolutely unfortunate and something that needs to be addressed. But that is right along the lines of Black civilization and the lack of Black civilization in the Black race, or the fact that the Black race has not had to build their own civilization in several thousand years. A civilization has societies within it. Within the societies, it has communities. Within all of that, again, there's a playbook. There are protocols, how we treat one another, how we protect one another, how we work with one another. And so when you don't have that, when you don't have a centralized way of doing that, yes, your women are going to be, bad things are going to be done to your women. Bad things are going to be done to your males. That is consistent with history as far as what centralized culture does and does not do. It helps protect, it helps educate, it helps strategic plan. If we had a centralized culture, we would be sitting somewhere discussing, okay, what do we need to do? Is it poor Black girls are getting abducted? Is it wealthy Black? Is it racism? Is it resentment? Or is it people resenting, you know, or the successful professional Black women? They're being targeted in, you know, what is going on? And so there would be strategic planning in this. We would sit down somewhere and discuss it, come up with a solution, come up with the protocols, and come up with a game plan, and then it would be executed either locally, nationally, or, you know, regionally, or in some cases internationally if necessary. That's what a centralized culture does. Now, we could wait for the government to do it. These are U.S. citizens, and I would expect it would. But, you know, when you have a centralized culture, it automatically does that before the government acts, just from self-preservation. And so I'm in North Carolina, and there was a big storm. I'm probably going to drop some water off this weekend, but there was a storm in western North Carolina, a big storm. And what people don't realize in North Carolina has a beautiful state, but there's a lot of flooding in certain areas. Charlotte is not that bad, but in like eastern North Carolina, big time flood areas. Western North Carolina, big time flood areas. And apparently, there's a county that has been Haywood County that had major flooding. 2 people died, and 20 people are missing right now. So when you look at the news flashes, you have all the people coming together as one. Just everybody, immediately, before anybody said anything, people were there. And that's what culture, now, these people are in a certain part of North Carolina. They know each other. They're familiar with each other. They look the same, to be honest with you. But bottom line is that the flood just happened. The storm just came. There were people there the next day, helping out, pitching in, bringing food. One guy said half of the people I've never seen before. There was an owner of a business that was the staging point for all of the clothes and food and supplies. And so his company, I think it was a beer. It might have been a beer distributor. But whatever it was, the man, the owner, is on his property. He's on his small factory. And the factory was close to the water line that they were trying to keep from coming in. And he said there were a bunch of people out there, and there were about a half of them he'd never seen. Not only did he not know them, he never saw them before in his life. But the community mindedness of the people and the culture and the unity of them all being one, almost like they were just a bunch of worker bees, didn't even have to be asked. You know, one of yours is down, everyone reacts, particularly when it's one of yours. And that's what culture does for an ethnic group that it has not been doing for the Black community. And so yes, the government and the law enforcement should definitely protect all of its citizens. Absolutely. But what can the Black community be doing? What should it be doing? What has it done? What has it done on a large scale? One thing I know, a centralized culture would help that. Go back to when Europe started colonizing the Western Hemisphere. Slavery was going on in Europe, but Europe also was nationalized. So the slaves that were the slaves, the opportunity to get slaves in Africa was just much easier, much less expensive than the opportunity to get slaves just about any place else. They could have gotten slaves in India, but they were using the coolies in India to work India. They could have gotten slaves in coolies in China. But the coolies and all those are basically slaves. They were used in China. So the slaves in Africa were actively sold to anyone who would buy them. And then the different tribes began making war on each other just to get slaves to give to the European brokers. And they were then sold to Western civilization. So these are the consequences of not having a centralized culture and not building your own civilization. And so, as I stated earlier, the Africans in West Africa that were there and not unified and completely tribalized and allowed to making them very vulnerable for European incursion, they originally were part of East Africa. And because of natural disaster, which was weather changes, which is actually happening now, we actually have weather changes now, but thousands of years ago, Africa had massive weather changes that made large tracts of East Africa, which the power was Ethiopia, the Ethiopian Empire, Egypt, And there was an empire in Sudan. So Upper Nile region, there were all kind of empires in Eastern Africa that were black. So, but natural disaster and Arab incursions migrating from Asia Minor began to, which is similar to America, where the people were threatened by an influx of different people. They began migrating west. And that's what brought them to West Africa. As they were migrating, they split up and went into different directions. As they landed in different parts of West Africa, they began developing their own languages and different cultures and different religions, basically. What we heard as a kid, a witch doctor, is simply a holy man in a tribal area. So we call them witch doctors, but that was a form of religion for that tribe. So when you now have a new tribe in West Africa, after migrating after migrating from East Africa a couple hundred years later, that new tribe is broken off from the other black people. It has its own language, it has its own culture, and literally has its own religion, making it another ethnic group within itself. So Africa essentially had 1,000 different ethnic groups within it, making it vulnerable for European incursion. And so that, of course, impacts unity. That, of course, impacts its ability to create society. It impacts its ability to thwart off other incursions from people outside that see the resources you have. That's another thing that Africa had, a lot of resources that people were not aware of, that once they were, they came there to take them. But not being unified was one that allowed people to do that. So like the great author Chancellor Williams said, in his book, The Destruction of Black Civilization, it talked about how black areas were occupied in the western regions and the eastern regions, and then migrated to the western regions. And this is what ended up being the weakened area of West Africa that was ultimately taken over by the West. Well, the labor was taken out of Africa, making the West strong, which allowed the West to ultimately come back 100 years later in the 1800s to colonize Africa and take it over. So actually, they did take over Africa outright. And so they literally gave them the resources to destroy them or to conquer them. And so these are the consequences of not being unified. My opinion, the consequences of the black man not needing to build and maintain his own civilizations and societies is he's become remedial in the area of military science. Military science is thousands of years ago should have understood we're giving labor to people who are going to take that labor, make themselves powerful, more powerful than we are, and then they're going to be able to take over all of us. So the tribal chiefs in Africa were short-sighted, did not look at the whole picture. The Indian chiefs in America were short-sighted. They did not look at the whole picture when we're talking about military science. I read a book called I did it as an audio book. It was a great audio book called The Mayflower. Mayflower was a great book. And it really got into it got into the word franchise, that the Pilgrims purchased a franchise to start Jamestown and to start their colonies in America, which is amazing. You know, it's kind of like McDonald's is a franchise. It's a system that helps you to put together the system to help you make money, to create wealth. And so from a meta, when I heard that in the book Mayflower, the you know, the story of the Mayflower and the pilgrims and the and settlers coming to America, it was amazing because it really drove home what this all was about. This was a financial venture. This was a reason different people came to this country that they did not own to create wealth, which is not evil. But it just shows how important money was in all of this and the creation of wealth. Well, the pilgrims, to make a long story short, in the Mayflower, the pilgrims are the, there were several Indian tribes around the settlers, according to the book, the Mayflower. And the settlers theorized that the Indians were plotting against them. The settlers said, hey, we're here. We just want to settle. We just want to live here in peace. We're going to farm, do our own farming, which was different from the Indians. The Indians were migratory. The farmers were, you know, planter-based, which in the long run, I think, allowed them to be more successful as far as production, which aided them against any migratory people on the globe. So, and you see that in history. But anyway, they supposedly just wanted to live there in peace and didn't want any trouble. Somehow they were afraid that the Indians were plotting against them to attack them. And there were not one tribe, there were several Indian tribes in the area. And so the pilgrims, the settlers, ambushed the Indians. It turned out they were right, and they were going to ambush the settlers, and so the settlers were right. The Indians were plotting, but they had not done it yet. This is the interesting thing. Being strategic planners, the settlers were smart. There was one tribe that they made war against that they ambushed, but there were several tribes around them. There was another tribe called, I think, the Epoch, that were very good economically. So what, I don't know if they were farmers or did they have their own industry, but they were an economic threat to the white settlers. So, of course, what did they do? They attacked them, too. Who, now, in the end, they attacked one Indian tribe that they suspected was plotting against them. They were correct. They then attacked the other tribe that was definitely not plotting against them because they were a strategic rival. Now, you can like or dislike their approach. That is called military science from the get-go. Okay? Here's the fault and the problem of the Indians. The white settlers played their card at that point. This was in the 1600s or 1500s. Remember, they said, oh, we're just here just trying to settle, and we just want to live here in peace. We're not going to take up much space. We just want this area over here, a couple of miles, and that's it. This is what the settlers said. Once they attacked that other Indian tribe, because they were an economic rival, they played their hand. At that point, the Indians, the jig is up. And all of the Indians in that area, in that region, sort of realized that these people are not only are they not going anywhere, not only are they not going to be simple neighbors, these people have aspirations for this whole region, that's beyond where they are now, making them a threat to every red tribe in that state, in that country. So what should the African tribes have done? Rose up to make sure they were not. They didn't. And why? Because they were different tribes. They were different races of people that had their own grudges and issues amongst themselves, that never saw the Europeans as a major threat to their way of life and their existence. It's funny because it did not take long for them to create their own society and then overtake theirs. This is military science. The black race is remedial in this. Power creation and acquisition and understanding how they work, making them vulnerable to other predatory ethnic groups, which they are, and a marginal ally at best, means you have to understand who's with you and who's against you. You also have to understand that someone who's not with you today could be with you tomorrow if the factors outside are different. So you have to constantly be thinking and thinking as a group and thinking strategically, which we're definitely, the black community is not good at. The so-called black community is quick to antagonize and alienate and disrespect one another with an emphasis on not being disrespected. This ecosystem of hostile discontinuity manifests itself in what I call the black zombie nation. And all that means is a race of people that don't understand, you know, power like they could and should, and that lack of understanding has long, far-reaching, and immediate consequences that they have to answer to and be willing to do that. So when you have black males being chased down and shot like it's Wild Kingdom, one reason that's done is because they know they can get away with it. There's not going to be any repercussions. There's not going to be any consequences to that, legally or any other and otherwise. So these are the things that societies do, and this is the things that the black community and black society does not. And essential culture is something that can happen. And that's just one aspect that gets a lot of attention. But truthfully, if you collectively built your community, if you collectively had schools, educated yourselves, you would, part of that is protecting each other and looking out for one another. So this is part of the consequences of that lack of culture, how it impacts unity. Now, I have been looking, reading the book, How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America by Professor Manning Marable. And there were aspects of the book that I wanted to talk about that I ran out of time. I wanted to get into the black church and how, you know, and its role in the discontinuity in its position. So, and the ambiguous. Manning Marable talks about the ambiguous politics of the black church. And I'm just going to read verbatim and see where it takes us. And then we'll discuss that, because I think Professor Manning's book is amazing, and he's one of our intellectuals. And so I think instead of me giving my opinion on it, I'd rather have it read it, his exact words, and then give my take on it. And so this is page 209, Ambiguous Politics of the Black Church. The minister, in accepting Christianity, also in some degree identified with the major moral values and institutions of white society. Consequently, it was relatively easy for him to work with whites, even though this sometimes amounted to a betrayal of blacks. Ooh. Marable goes right at it. So, to understand that, you have to understand the history of the black church, where the black church came from, and who gave it to us. I always thought, there were large numbers of slave revolts in the 16, 1700s, and the black planters realized they needed something, a platform to help them and help their cause of slavery. And so the black church was actually utilized as one of those killers to do that. And so the preacher was called upon to tell the slaves to be good Christians and obey your master. And so to ultimately obey your master like God. And so it's a simple principle. So, and that's one way that the preacher, I think this is what Professor Marable is referring to as kind of a portrayal, a betrayal of blacks. Now, another preacher actually made a point, and it's good that he made that point because we read a couple of books, and one problem that black people have in our unity and continuity, black people that read a couple of books and think everyone that doesn't wear dashiki is a sellout, anyone who likes white people is a sellout, and that's not the case at all. And so so when you read a couple of books, you're going to start, oh, the black church is a tool of white supremacy. In some cases it is, but only because the black people in the church aren't strong with black culture, military science, and understanding their power. A preacher said that originally the black church, and it makes sense, was literally a platform for insurrection. And the slave planters realized there's no way we can allow this. This is the one place we allow them to meet, the church. If you think about it, they're not allowed to meet anywhere else. So when it comes to them coming together as a community, it's almost impossible outside of the church. At that point, the black church needed to be usurped by the white planters and then turned into a tool or a component of the white greater society's white supremacy. And so it also, in the book New Americans by Barron, I think his name was, it mentioned that a black man who was entrepreneurial post-slavery really couldn't get loans. He really couldn't, had no money. Relatives had no money. So as far as starting a business, that was kind of hard. The best place for him, if you were an enterprising black man, is to become a preacher because you had a reservoir of income from your parish, you know, the people, your church members. So if you wanted to do something economically, that is a way that a lot of black males went. Unfortunately, that means he's saying that there are a lot of people that went to the pulpit that weren't necessarily called to the pulpit. There were a lot of people that went to that pulpit that were business-minded, which is not a bad thing, but they were not called by God. So they were not there on some higher purpose, a higher calling. They were there for them. And so, and I think you see certainly not every black preacher, but you definitely see remnants of that, the consequences of that in the black church and its lack of proactivity. Again, when Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968, April 4th, he was very unpopular in the United States. One area who he was surprisingly unpopular with is the clergy, and particularly the black clergy that was traditionally conservative, didn't want to make waves, and what have you. So when we talk about the ambiguous politics of the black church, we have to also delve into the reality of the black preacher being essentially like a professional athlete, where you are financially compensated and respected. And, you know, the matter of fact, the black preacher was the only man in the black community in the South, definitely. He was the only man that could literally be a man. And probably he had to deal with, disrespect as well. But at least they didn't mind you respecting the preacher because the preacher was telling you to basically stay in your place. Let's read further. Manning Marable, boy, this is a great book. This is a small passage. From this passage, I have a whole lot of thoughts. As for Martin himself, the young black nationalist had little sympathy. As the crisis of black America deepened, Allen wrote, King was converted
into a reluctant accomplice of the white power structure. The white elites discovered that King was useful to restrain the threatening rebelliousness of the black masses and the militant. Ooh, here we go again. Manning Marable. I'm glad I read his stuff verbatim, because that's the only way to really get into it. Now, what Professor Manable is saying here, which is true, we just said that the first of all, the preacher was like a professional athlete. He was compensated well and respected and looked at and lauded on by many of the people in the community, including white people. He's saying that in the lack of culture, I saw Dr. King's house, which was shocking. I played professional football for 10 years and had a decent house at the time. I went and I saw the house that Martin Luther King Jr. was raised in. Dr. King's father was a preacher as well, prominent preacher as well. His house that he grew up in the 1930s and 20s was as big as my house, what it looked as big as my house that I lived in 2005. So safe to say, Martin Luther King Jr., and this was always a concern of his, was from the bourgeois factor or considered, quote-unquote, upper crust segment of the black population. And so as a preacher, it was quick for the black militants, the young black nationalists, your Malcolm X's, your Huey P. Newton's, your Fred Hamptons, to look negatively at Dr. King. He was not moving quick enough. He didn't mind talking to white people. He was a preacher. Preachers always take treated well. He's from a upper crust segment of the population. So for it wasn't hard at all for black nationalists to look at Martin Luther King funny and to look at him almost to call him a sellout, which is crazy. And so then it says, furthermore, King could not repudiate this role because he was convinced that the establishment could be pushed and pressured to implement his program. Now, back to military science. First of all, we talk about black militancy. And there were times where black people had to be violent, usually defensive. There wasn't a insurgency of black militants. That was literally never an option for the black population in America. And if it were, what it would take to conduct an insurgency by the black population in America, it would take a whole lot of unity and continuity. And if you had that, you probably wouldn't need force in the first place, because you could use economics and politics. Because this is a country, this is a society that literally moves on economics. It moves everything. It moves politics. It moves sociology. It moves everything. So if the black population could control its economics, which it has not been able to do individually or even on a massive scale, probably wouldn't need an insurgency, I'm guessing. But bottom line, here's what Dr. King is saying. He found the white elites useful in getting his program implemented in what he wanted to do for who? Black America. He's saying, now this is military science and what the black population is not good at. He's saying, y'all not going to war anyway. Not realistic. Here's what we can do. And in doing so, there are some white people that we will have to work with. And there are some white people that are willing to work with us. So the militancy was saying, you are Uncle Tom. And so this is the failure of black civilization. This is the failure of not having a central culture, not being one people, not understanding how we can all get on the same page. Even though we're different, even though we're from different parts, we have the same objectives, and these different parts have different opportunities. See, that street dude has a different opportunity to make change to impact society than even Dr. King. He's connected to the underworld. If someone, if there's force and violence that needs to be done, maybe that underworld guy can do it. Maybe that street thug can do it. Martin Luther King has a tool. He has a position. He has a play. He has a place that he's playing. He has a position that he can play as far as working with the establishment. Okay, y'all don't want violence. Y'all don't want the streets in the, you know, you don't want the cities burning. This is what they need. They need affordable health care. They need this. They need to be able to vote. This is something that Martin Luther King was doing. And you know what? Malcolm X had a role, as he stated to Dr. King. Why do you think these white people don't mind working with you? They don't want to deal with me. I'm completely necessary to what you're doing, Dr. King, because at that time, they had disagreements. Martin Luther King being wholeheartedly with nonviolence that he learned from Gandhi, and a nonviolent movement was the move. And of course, Malcolm X was a, you know, any means by necessary person. If you mess with me, I'm gonna mess with you. You touch mine, I'm gonna touch one of yours. So they were radically different views from two equally great men. But in many ways, you know, the King and that group didn't want the radical black nationalists, Black Panthers and what have you. They did not feel that that was a viable option, and that this was the most efficient option for us. And so there was discontinuity between the, particularly the younger generations, particularly the late 60s. You have the Black Panthers, you have you have the militants, you have A-Trap Browns, you have the Fred Hamptons, you have the Eldridge Cleavers, you have the Stokely Carmichael, who was with Dr. King and then became more militant. The Black Power movement was a younger generation that didn't want to take shit from anybody. And so Dr. King's organization was looked at as the old guard that passed their time and passed their prime. Well, he did a whole lot for the country and a whole lot for black people, but he wasn't viewed as that. I'm saying that the lack of a central culture, the lack of a oneness that a culture does, is one of the main reasons that existed. That a central culture would have given them all the ability to strategic plan. This is why I'm doing this. This is how it's going to help us, and blah, blah, blah. Culture can do that. And so a central culture can do that. And I'm not sure that I'm sure that we could have done a lot more had we been more unified and had more continuity, which we were not. And so now I have no doubt there's assertions that there were secret meetings between Dr. King and Malcolm X. That's certainly possible and probably likely. But they were not. There was not a coordinated movement between Dr. King, the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X, and Black Panther. So more probably could have been done had that existed. But anyway, that's all I have for today. I wanted to get into Manning Marable. I'm glad I did. His book is cool. It's one of a few books I have. I didn't think I was going to be in this book long, but he's got a lot of good stuff that he's saying in here. And any good writer, any good book, even if you don't agree with everything they say, should make you think. And that's exactly what his book does. And so I'm going to sign off today. I hope I've made my case. This is your host, Clarence Jones, trying to make a case for the need of a centralized culture in the black population, and for that need and for the possibility and the great opportunity that I believe Kwanzaa presents to the black population and ultimately the United States of America. Thanks a lot. You guys have a great weekend. I'm signing off. Take care.